You see me? Okay. Good morning, everybody. For all of our viewers and listeners throughout the world, so I want to tell you that today is the first day that Yerushalayim is partially beginning to return to semi-normalcy after the storm of the century, snowstorm. It started, everybody has stories. Some things ended up not so bad. My daughter in Beit Vagan had no electricity, so it took them about 2 hours before Shabbos to make their way to our house, and they came, daughter, son-in-law, their daughter, and her husband, and the baby. We had a wonderful 4 days with great grandson. Okay? So that was one of the benefits. And then finally, we got them out. We had another one that came, another angel that came floating into the house. You know, listen, Jews take care of their refugees. Right, that was a political comment, all right. But let's say the following. There was, this morning, as I went out to the car to come here, was the first time I stepped out of the house since Friday morning. I did one of the maddest things, I don't know why I did it, but I'll serve a table. Friday morning, I went to shul. It's three buildings over. It was the most difficult walk I ever made in my life. And I come into shul to find two people, and one of them left. So there it is. We are two people in shul. Two people in shul. So I decided I'm walking home, and I'll tell you, I was praying all the way home for the Bnei Shalom. I should make it home. It was so difficult. Each step was very difficult. We've got to make sure that we get all of this down for all times so that it's on record. So anyway, but I think that there most probably were a lot of people were helping a lot of other people. There was a tremendous amount of chesed in this country, and the opposition in this country has always had one problem. I see that my dear friend Yitzchak Isaac Halevi Herzog is calling for an investigation of the government's mishandling of the storm, you understand, and because they believe that the opposition has only one purpose, to oppose. Whatever it is, if the government says the sun is shining, oppose it. Not so. Oppose. They did a pretty good job under the extremely difficult circumstances. It was difficult, and we're the heroes, and we're digging out of this. And of course, the greatest story of the storm Friday. The Daf Yomi for Friday was Masechet Yoma Daf Lamed He. And Lamed He on the base is the famous story. Hold on to your seats. Have your seatbelts on. The famous story of Hillel, who didn't have enough money to pay and get into the Beis Medrash, but he wanted to listen to the shir of Shemaya and Avtalion. So he went up on the roof, and overnight, snow fell and covered him. When they came in the morning, they see some figure up there. Now you ready? The Gemara says, Oto Hayom, that day was Erev Shabbos, and it was Tevet. On an Erev Shabbos in Tevet, the snow came down on Hillel. That was the Daf Yomi of Friday. That's all I don't know what to do with it, it's just a... what a coincidence. What a coincidence. All right, there's a lot more, but We have a shir to say there will yet be many articles written about the great storm, the great storm. The only thing I remember that comes close to it, maybe was even bigger than that, was the snowstorm in New York of 1947. I don't know how many of you remember the blizzard of 47. That was unbelievable. That was unbelievable. And we've been living, I lived in Toronto for 12 years. We didn't have anything like the blizzard of 47. Okay, sure, that the brothers that can talk about the blizzard of 1889 or the others, but I go back to about 47. All right. So there was another advantage to the storm. I don't know. I was shut in for so many that I didn't step out much. Didn't step out. Friday morning at 20 after 7, I didn't go out the door of my apartment until this morning, when, with some small ray of hope, I went down to see. You know, Noah had to wait for the bird, the dove, to tell him what's going on. I went downstairs to see did the Jerusalem Post arrive. And it was there! Then I knew that the storm was coming to an end. But I had time. I sat in the house for 72, 70 hours. So I did some Googling, and I'm telling you, I don't think I ever did something. I was going crazy. I was making a fellow called Martin Kahane crazy. Every time I found something, I called him. And it all has to do with number three. Take a look at number three. I may concentrate on number three. Number three was an article that appeared last week in the Jerusalem Post. Pictures at an exhibition on the next Holocaust by Walter Reich. When he was the Deputy Secretary of State, and I, Walter Reich, was the Director of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, I escorted Strobe Talbot through the museum. We passed a letter that John J. McCloy wrote. I escorted Strobe Talbot through the museum. Have I read it correctly so far? Okay, we paused. Okay, we paused at a letter that John J. McCloy wrote on August 14, 1944, to the head of the Rescue Department of the World Jewish Congress. In that letter, McCloy responded to a request that, quote, certain installations and railroad centers, unquote, at Auschwitz be bombed. The installations included the gas chambers, in which as many as 10,000 Jews were being killed every day. The railroad centers were the tracks that were bringing Jews to the gas chambers. McCloy rejected the request. He said, quote, that such an operation could be executed only by the diversion of considerable air support essential to the success of our forces now engaged in decisive operations elsewhere and would not warrant the use of our resources. Now, the next sentence, of course, it's bad enough till now, but the next sentence, there has been considerable opinion to the effect that such an effort, even if practicable, might provoke even more vindictive actions by the Germans. Pray tell me how much more vindictive can you become than gassing Jews to death? I read this. I mean, we knew all of this stuff, but you know, sometimes it hits you in the kishkes. My kishkes got it. And then McCloy's letter was mounted next to photos of Auschwitz taken from American planes flying over the death camp to bomb military targets a few miles away. Some 2,800 flew over or near the camp. So there, then my imagination took over. I was thinking of McCloy calling his secretary Mary. Mary, I want to dictate a letter. And there she has one leg over the other with her steno pad over there. And she's writing it down. Does she object to anything? Does she tell him, boss, you're out of your mind, boss? No, I don't think so. I don't think so. Understand? And that's okay. Off goes the letter. And at the same time that I read this, all of a sudden something strikes me. You know what strikes me? It takes great courage to speak out. This is the guy who I made crazy last night, calling him every time I found something else. So I'm reading this article, and I think to myself, take a look at number one. Vayehi vayomim harav mahalath. In those days, vayigdal Moshe grew up. And he went down to his brothers, and he saw their burdens, and he saw an Egyptian striking a Hebrew from his brothers. He turned here and there, and he saw Kienish. Now we will see the meaning. He was not looking around to see if anybody is going to observe him in the act that he's about to do. He's looking around. Is there anybody here who's ready to listen to somebody who's going to complain about what's going on? What's going on? Is there any authority you can talk to? Is there anybody speaking up on behalf of the slaves? Is there anybody saying, stop this, you can't do this? Nobody. Long goes Moshe. Vayachat HaMitzri. He struck the Mitzri. Vayibaneu b'chol. And he hid him in the sand. You see what's taking place over there? It's 2,300 years since the creation of the world, and this is the first blow in history that struck for freedom. First, Moshe Rabbeinu, the first one to speak up. I would have thought, of course, that God, what this would mean. So then we're going to find out the next day. He goes out, and there are two Jews fighting with one another, and they were totally unimpressed by what he did the day before. They must probably be thinking, hey, with the kind of stuff you're doing, you're going to provoke Paro even more. They don't appreciate that a great blow has been struck for freedom. Let's go back to the article for a minute. The next paragraph. The systematic murder of the Jews at Auschwitz was already known by the U.S. government. Asked what they would have felt had American bombers bombed the gas chambers or railroad lines, Auschwitz survivors said that they would have been overjoyed, even if the bombs had missed their targets, or even if the Germans would have repaired the tracks. At least they said they would have known that the Allies had tried to do something to stop it all. I have a feeling that, well, we're going to see soon one of an unusual and a beautiful pshat in the pasuk that said by the Ketav HaKabbalah. Back to the pasuk, it says over there, Vayyar, the first pasuk, Vayyar ish Mitzri matke ish Ivri and it repeats Mei Echav from amongst his brothers. So the Ksamar Karbala, we're going to see it. We get to it, you know, there's not coming yet. He says, you know what happened over there? There were many Jews standing. And this mitzvah chose Jew, you. From amongst his brothers, he chose one and began to beat him. And all the rest are watching. And everybody remains silent. They've lost the ability to cry out. They've lost the ability to stand up to the enemy. And then he understands that the situation has become that difficult. Somebody has to stand up and be an example. And by the way, he knows. We'll see some of the first one. Malbim says, Vayifen Kova Ko. He looked here and there if anybody can help or if there's any authority to talk to. What Moshe did was not something that he did in the moment, the heat of the moment. He sees a Mitzri beating a Jew. No. It was thought out. He had time. He looked. He was concerned. And he made a conscious decision. This guy has to be struck down. This is another thing. I think in this sukkah, every word is meaningful. First pasuk says, "Vayetze el Echav." There are only about 3-4 places in Chumash where a person is described as going out. Vayetze Yaakov mi Be'er Sheva, Vayelech Choromo. Yaakov left Be'er Sheva and he went to Chorom. In Parsha Vayishlach it says, Vayetze Dina Basleo. Dina Basleo went out to see what's happening with the daughters of Lenin, and she got into serious trouble. The end of Parshat Devar, it says, Vayetze ben ish mitzvi, a man went out into the camp and he cursed God. The Mekalil at the end of Parshat Devar. Otherwise, when it talks about people going someplace, it says Vayelech. You know what the common denominator of Vayetze is? Let's begin with Yaakov. Yaakov is stepping out of one world, entering a completely different world. From home and family and Eretz Yisrael, he's stepping out into Golus, into a home of Rishus. Lohan Harami. He is moving from one world into a completely different world, and it's frightening and it's terrifying. Vatetze Dina bat Leah, Dina, the daughter of Leah, goes out. She's leaving the home of Yaakov and she's going to investigate and see what's happening in a completely different world that is antithetical to everything that Judaism stands for. By Vayetze, the Mekalel goes out. Rashi says, Mei Olamo Yatsa. He left his world into a world where one blasphemes God. Vayetze El Echov. The first step that Moshe Rabbeinu takes, you know what he understands? He's going out of the world of power, pomp, prominence. Rashi says he had been appointed a second paro. That's another P, paro. And he's walking out to see those slaves, but those slaves are his brothers, and he knows that he's stepping out from one world into a completely different world. and this may change his life drastically and dramatically. Every word is full of meaning. We'll come back to that. But I was sitting around in the house. I couldn't go out. I wasn't going to join the army of people with sponge sticks in the street who were trying to fight the great winter storm. It was funny. Nobody has shovels over there. If I would be near Barkat, I would make sure that every home would have salt. We used to put out salt. You know how many days it was dangerous? People were slipping as they walked out of their house. Salt. All right, that was my investigations. So I'll tell you exactly what I did. And if you want to, you can do the same thing. I Googled John J. McCloy, the letter writer. This letter writer, this letter writer held major positions in American government for 50 years. He was a lawyer and banker who served as assistant secretary of war during World War II. That's when he wrote the letter. He was president of the World Bank. He was U.S. High Commissioner for Germany. He was chairman of Chase Manhattan Bank and chairman of the Council on Foreign Relations. He later became a prominent United States presidential advisor. He served on the Warren Commission that investigated the Kennedy assassination and was a member of the Foreign Policy Establishment group of elders called the Wise Men. He was also one of the main lawyers at Nuremberg. This guy had a history. But wait, the history starts a few years before the August 14th, 1944 letter. He was the one who made the decision that Japanese Americans should be put into concentration camps in California. He made the decision. He had them built in a matter of weeks, and they started moving loyal Americans all over California into concentration camps. One of the great blows against the rights of citizens, this guy. But you know what, I'm looking for one thing. The Auschwitz bombing debate. This is all from this Wikipedia. Yeah, during World War II as Assistant Secretary of State of War, McCloy was crucial in setting U.S. military priorities. The U.S. War Department was petitioned throughout late 1944 to help save Nazi prisoners by ordering the bombing of the railroad lines leading to Auschwitz. McCloy responded that only heavy bombers would be able to reach the sites from England and that those bombers would be too vulnerable and were needed elsewhere. McCloy claimed that the final decision on the selection of bombing targets included those attacked by American planes labeled the British alone. And I was like, all good guys, he knows exactly where to shift the blame. It's they're at least honest enough to say this was an incorrect claim. According to Michael Belschloss, in an interview 3 years before the latter's death, before McCloy's death in 1986, he interviewed Henry Morgenthau III. McCloy claimed that the decision not to bomb Auschwitz was President Roosevelt's, and that he was merely fronting for him. Now, Roosevelt already was long dead, so of course, Roosevelt could not deny, and I don't know, maybe it was Roosevelt's decision. McCloy also alleged to Morgenthau that Roosevelt refused to approve the Auschwitz rail bombing because he would then be accused of also killing Auschwitz prisoners. In the early 1970s, McCloy stated that he himself could no more order a bombing attack on Auschwitz than order a raid on Berlin. And then they bring a whole bunch of examples where he ordered more serious actions undertaken since Van Gogh. You can always go Google it yourself. I'm sure it's tremendous reading over there. Tremendous reading. But then I Googled one other, and that's when things started becoming a little bit more interesting. I Googled, what is this? Further reading, additional resources. There's a site here called, I don't know what it is, Natural History. I don't know, John Cloy. What? I mean, you know, you gotta listen to this. It's Torah. This is Mamish Torah. This is what we're gonna see right over here. McCloy's brother-in-law, Lewis W. Douglas, was a member of the Democratic Party, and in March 1933 he was appointed director of the budget by President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. That's quite a position in March 33 to be in charge of the budget. However, Douglas became convinced that the New Deal had been infiltrated by communists. Douglas told McCloy, his brother-in-law, the Schwager, he, Roosevelt, is surrounded with the young Harvard Law School group, all of whom are communists. Douglas also believed that the New Deal was part of a Jewish conspiracy to destroy the capitalist system. You know, we're either accused of running the capitalist system and being the guys with all the money, and here, Douglas, the Schwager, believes that Jews want to destroy capitalism. He talked about the Hebraic influence and claimed that most of the bad things which it, the administration, has done can be traced to it. As a race, they seem to lack the quality of facing an issue squarely. As a result of his beliefs, Douglas resigned from the government in August 1934. This is a real sugar. He really believes it. He's ready. He gave up his position. I give him credit, don't say it. Then, what's it? Okay. Yeah, but I can keep reading. I'm not going to read. I only look for one thing, and that one thing comes over here. Okay. He writes the letter. The letter we're talking about. Not agreeing to bomb Auschwitz over rail lines. Then it says, first of all, that American bombers couldn't make it. This was not true. Long-range American bombers stationed in Italy had been flying over Auschwitz and the neighboring IG Farben petrochemical plant since April 1944. The American Air Force was also bombing Germany's synthetic fuel plants in regions very close to the death camps. In fact, in August 1944, the Monowitz camp, part of the Auschwitz complex, was bombed by accident. They were so close, they were right there. Okay? And then it says, you know, this stop me. Benjamin Axin, one of McCloy's aides, disagreed with McCloy's decision. How do you like that? Somebody did raise his voice in opposition. Whoever this Benjamin Axin is, disagreed with McCloy's decision. He pointed out that if the transport links and the death camps were bombed, it would force the Germans to spend considerable time and resources to reconstruct the gas chambers and the rail lines. And that would divert a lot of their important materials to have to do that. On the contrary, bombing them would help the war effort. that I wanted to find out, Miru Zeva Ezahu, who is this Benjamin Axin? Oh, I mean, that was one of the calls I made to Rabbi Nachman Kahana. I think the third or fourth time that I called him. You know, I told him there was somebody who spoke up, Benjamin Axin. So he tells me, Benjamin Axin, there was a judge on the Supreme Court in Israel called Binyamin Axin. So, I googled Benjamin Axin. Axin was born in 1904 in Riga, Latvia, then in Livonia. It was then part of Livonia in the Russian Empire. He completed doctorates in political science and law at the universities of Vienna and Paris. He was an admirer. Yeah, you see, bells on. He was an admirer of Zev Jabotinsky and became active in the Jabotinsky's revisionist movement and served as secretary to Jabotinsky. Following Jabotinsky's break with the Zionist organization and his founding of the new Zionist organization, Axin served as head of the political division of the NZO from 1936 to 1941. In the late 1930s, Axin traveled to the United States to complete a third doctorate at Harvard University. Those are the guys from Harvard, the lawyers from Harvard that Douglas the Sugar saw as running the United States of America. He spent a period with the Legal Department of Library of Congress and was then appointed to a position on the staff of the War Refugee Board, which had been established by President Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1944 under pressure from the United States Congress, Jewish activists, and the Treasury Department. By the way, whenever we talk about this, we have to remember one thing. The Great March of 400 Rabbanim, led by Reb Lazer Silva and Rav Rosenberg, the heads of the Agudas HaRabbanim, the only rabbinic act during the Second World War. 400 rabbis came to Washington. I think it was a few days before Yom Kippur. Rav Soloveitchik was there. Zweis, Rebbes, Rav Meivum, Rosh Yeshiva, all came. And Roosevelt refused to see them. Wouldn't see them. Anyway, let's go back to Benjamin Axin. In 1944, when the WRB began receiving reports of massive deportation of Jews to the chaos chambers at Auschwitz and Birkenau, Axin presented a memorandum to the WRB, the War Refugee Board, and he was the one that suggested that they should bomb the gas chambers and the rail lines. Although Axin persisted in his efforts, there's one man, who persists in his efforts. His proposals were rejected by the U.S. administration, at least in part, because the same idea had previously been rejected by leading Jewish organizations. This I can't read now, because if I have to tell you everything behind this, it will take a whole day. Terrible thing they wrote it about. That's for later. Anyway, the important thing is the following. In 1949, Axin emigrated to Israel and joined the faculty of law at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem as professor of constitutional law. He went on to receive Pras Yisrael. He was Binyamin Axin. And this Benjamin Axin was sort of God's plant in the American government, right close to this guy McCloy. At least there was one voice that was raised. That voice is the voice of a Moshe Rabbeinu kind of voice. Now you know what I was doing during the snow. Found out about Binyamin Axin, by John McCloy. There is so much I can keep going here for another hour or two reading. I suggest, if you want it, this is a story of such awesome proportions. I have no idea. So if you have time, or the next snowstorm, Google John J. McCloy and Benjamin Axin. What you will learn over here, about the Sinas Yisrael of an American government and the silence of just about everybody around them. You know, we also have to mention one other person. Bergson, Hill Cook, who organized the first great demonstration in Madison Square Garden, calling on America to stop the killing in Europe. Peter Bergson, that was Hill Cook's, he was a nephew of Avraham Yitzchak Akamin Cook, and he was a revisionist. These guys, they tried their best. All right, that's it, where are we? By the way, this is the picture in the Jerusalem Post. The one with his back over here is Elie Wiesel, his cousin. Well, let's put it better. Not that way. No, that's it. Elie Wiesel's greatness and his claim to fame is he's his cousin. That's it. Okay. He's also Wiesel. Okay. Back to our... We've had similar instances during the course of the last 20 years. There are moments at which Jews here in Eretz Yisrael and our dear friends in America should have stood up and protested. And they didn't. I'm not going to tell you how much time I spent in the United States in 1994 and 1995 speaking with rabbis and rebbes, etc., etc., to fight Oslo, because Oslo is going to be a profound tragedy for the Jewish people. You know what? They wrote me off as an extremist. I made similar journeys to the United States before the expulsion from Gush Katif. I remember right on the street right out here, one of the members of my former congregation, West Hempstead, coming for a visit, part of a group of American Jewish leaders who met with Prime Minister Sharon, and she knew that I was opposed to it, and she looks at me and she laughs, "You don't know what this is going to mean. This is going to bring peace to Israel. Israel is going to be beloved in the world. You don't understand." And I look at her, "What are you talking about? It's going to turn into a center of world terrorism. We're going to suffer from it." Who was it, Yossi Sablin, who said, they're going to be rockets on Ashkelon. You understand? Boy, did they come, the raketot on Ashkelon. People should have gotten up and protested. They did. Some of my best friends. So you know what? Yeah, I'll tell you something else. This was not planned to be part of this year. There's a famous Gemara on this week's Sabbath. How do you like this? On this week's Sabbath. Gemara says that there were three members of Paro's cabinet. When Paro gathered his people in Wannsee to decide on the final solution of the Jewish people. Three members. Bilam, Iov, and Yitro. And when it came to the vote, Bilam said, "Kill the dirty Jews." Okay? Or whatever you want to do with them. Iov remained silent. Yitro objected and fled. Therefore, the Gemara says, Bilam. Bilam was killed ultimately. Yitro became the Shver of Moshe Rabbeinu. And you know what? You know how I understand it now? What did they say in Yiddish? An Eden is a halbe schwer. You know that Yiddish expression? A son-in-law is great similarities to his father-in-law. The two people who protested were Yitro and Moshe. They're the two that spoke up. Sometimes I think maybe it means that the Eden is even much greater than the Shver. Eov, who remained silent, his punishment was to suffer. So I remember hearing this so many years ago in Yeshiva that the Pesach Yechov had asked, so what kind of punishment is that? What kind of punishment is that? Eov assumed there's nothing that he can do. If Paro and Bilam have decided, you know, there's nothing I can do, so he abstained. He abstained, he said nothing. So the famous book that they say in the name of the Brisker Rav is, Eov at least should have given a kirechts, oyvei, because if it really hurts you, what do you do when something hurts you? A krechts. He didn't even give a krechts. For that, his punishment was to krechts and krechts. I remember saying that to a group of yeshiva bachurim who accosted me. I think I was standing with my wife at the Knesset to Yerushalayim. You know, the light by Givat Shaul, and we were holding up signs protesting. Then it was a protest against Oslo. And a few yeshiva brachim walked by. What's it gonna help? What's it gonna help? What are you doing over here? Nobody even cares. So I told him, yeah? You know that Gemara? Yeah, sure. You know what the Brisker Rav said there? Yeah. You know what I'm doing over here on the street, on the highway? I'm giving a krechts. Where's your krechts? Those guys were, they had it. They were wiped out with that. Kaiser Fulham carried. Well, I'm beginning to relive all sorts of things. This guy, John J. McCloy, he's most probably, his Gehenna. Right, you know, we're going to learn a few psukim, and there's a lot that's left, and that maybe we'll continue next week. That was really the point of all of this, you know? I wanted to be able to stretch the shiur out into 2 weeks.
No.
But he went down to his brothers. And we explained that the word over here, Vayetzi, is not the normal word to be used. Vayetzi, it should have said Vayelech. He went to his brothers, but no, he understands exactly what he's doing. He's fully aware. That day when he walks out of the palace, he knows that he's stepping out of one world into a completely different world, and he cannot know how it's going to end. Vayetze, and you know why he went out? For only one reason. He didn't go out to get a breath of fresh air. He went out for one purpose and one purpose alone. He wants to connect with his brothers. Vayar b'simlo tam, and he saw their suffering. Vayar. That's a very meaningful word, Vayar b'simlo tam. Some years ago, I told you in a different context, one of the great verter of Soloveitchik. End of benching, we say, Naru, you see, Gamzo Kanti, the Lora Iti Tzadik Nesav. I was young and I grew old, and I didn't see a Tzadik who had been abandoned, the Zaro Mazaki Shlokhem and his children are begging for bread, seeking bread. We never saw that. And I don't know if you should just go to your mailbox every day, you'll find out about another 12 Yisraelim that are up to read, another 5 Yisraelim. I mean, there is poverty, there's been hunger. How can the Rambam say, I didn't see any tzaddik nezah. It's a very big kasha. You didn't go through your whole life saying you didn't really know what it says. Thank God you came here. In the snow, you came today. Here it is. So Chov said the following. Over here, the word vayyar, he's not talking about here, he's talking about lo ro'isi, I didn't see tzaddik nezah, the tzaddik nevarkish lochem. So the Chov said the following. In the Gilat Esther, Esther says to Achashverosh, Eich er'eh, what's the word? How can I see the suffering of my brother, my family? How can I see that? You know what the word see over there means? How can I see and do nothing? Seeing, there are things that you see that imply that I have to do something. How can I stand by idly and see my brothers and sisters, my whole people, being taken to destruction? The Chof says, that's a part of Lo Ra'isi. I never saw tzaddik suffering and just looked and did nothing. I looked with the intent to do something. Whenever I saw, I was moved to action. Vayam b'sivlo tam. Moshe Rabbeinu is not a bystander. He's not just looking. He sees the burdens. What do you mean, see the burdens? You know what seeing means in this context? Seeing and planning to do whatever is in his power to relieve the suffering of his brothers and sisters. And then, Vayar Ish Mitzri, Make Ish Ivri Me'echo. He saw an Ish Mitzri who's striking Ish Ivri. So we already said one shot on Ish Ivri Me'echo, the brilliant Ksava Kabbalah, that there were a large group of Jews there, and he had picked out one and began to beat him. By the way, the simple meaning of the pasuk is this Ish Mitzri is striking this person only because he's Jewish, because he's Me'echov. There's no point to what he's doing. We're not talking about an Ish Ivri who wasn't doing his job. He was goofing off. No. Chose him for only one reason, because he's Me'echov. And then Vayifen Kovacho, Vayar Kienish, he turned here and there and he saw that there's nobody to talk to. There's nobody to talk to. There isn't even a Benjamin Acton around to be seen. And you can't blame, and no, I'm not blaming Jews. They're already so beaten, so downtrodden. So therefore he struck the Mitzri and he hit him in the sand. Let's take a look at a Rashi. Number two is the Rashi. The second Rashi that I have underlined by Yarbisid Lotam. He saw their suffering. He saw their burdens. What a Rashi. Rashi says, Natan einav v'libo liyot meitzar aleim. Does that fit in with how we learn Pshat and Vayar? He didn't just look. He's not just, you know, it comes with his camera and his light meter, and he's, I'm still thinking of the old days, you know, yeah. You don't use light meters anymore. He's not just looking. He's looking, but his looking is Nosan Enof Lelivo, his eyes and his heart, Liyot Meitzar Aleim, to be distressed over them. You know what's happened over here? I'll tell you what's happened over here. There's a Rashi, the first Rashi in Parashat Vayechi. I think I even have it over here. If you go to number 8, second page, number 8, Vayechi Yaakov Be'eretz Mitzrayim, 17 Shana, Yaakov lived in the land of Egypt 70 years, and the days of Yaakov were 147 years. Rashi says, listen to the, let's look at that Rashi. Vayechi Yaakov, Lola Parsha Zul Stuma. Rashi asks, why is Parsha Vayechi Stuma? You know what it means, that Parsha Vayechi is closed? Between the end of Vayigash and the beginning of Vayechi, there is no pause whatsoever in Torah. It's all one long run-on sentence. Throughout Torah, there are spaces and pauses. There's a Parsha Psucha. A Parsha Psucha means that wherever we finish the Parsha before, we stop there and leave the rest of the line without any writing. And the next pasuk begins on the next line. A Parsha Stuma is where we start the next Parsha. That's the Samach that you find in a printed Chumash. The Samach means that we leave in the Sefer Torah, there's a space of 9 letters. But between Vayigash and Vayechi, nothing. No space. So Rashi asks, Loma Parsha Zu Stuma. Why is this Parsha Stuma? Lefisha Kima Shenifta Yaakov Avinu. Because once our forefather Jacob passed away, Nistimu Einehem V'Libam SheYisrael Mitzoras HaShibud. The eyes and the heart of the Jewish people were closed. They lost the ability to see and to feel. And then, one day, Moshe comes, and you know what he does? He uses his eyes and his heart. He is the beginning of a new era. What was closed at the beginning of Parsha Vayechi with the death of Yaakov, all of a sudden there's one Jew who opens up his eyes and opens up his heart. That's the first step. Vayavis in Lotam, he saw and he knows that he has to do something about him. It's not stam he sees, and you know, very interesting. Not interesting at all. It's painful. It's very painful. All right. Then let's go a little further. You know, this is legitimately going to turn into a 2-week shiur. There's too much to say. I'm afraid when I get into the next pasuk, my time is only up. We have another few minutes. We started late, and
all the time you want.
All the time I want. And you're not going to start till and until I finish, okay? And I don't have to go teach in Kol Sinai, because Kol Sinai sent me an email and left a message on my phone that there will not be Kolel today. Something to do with the weather, I think. You know, some places have to make decisions. Okay. He went down on the second day. For he named, behold, Shnei Anoshim Ivrim Nitzim. Two Jews are locked in struggle. Vayomer LeRosha, and he said to the Rosha, Lomo Taker Eyecho, why do you strike your friend? Vayomer, so he responds to Moshe by saying, Misom Chol Ish Sar B'Shofet Aleinu, who made you a ruler and a judge over us? Mind your own business. How Hargeni Ata Omer, do you plan on killing me, Kasher Arakta Ta Mitzri, like you killed the Mitzri? Vayida, Moshe was frightened. Vayomer, Achein No Da HaDavar, it is known. Now, Rashi now becomes more meaningful to me. Because, you know, if we're saying the pshat of the Ksava HaKabbalah, that he had chosen one Jew from amongst many Jews, so did Moshe think that nobody's going to know about it? There are a few hundred Jews standing here watching what's happening. Rashi says, Amochi Nanda Hadava, now I know why they're suffering. If Jews can betray fellow Jews, Achenvei, we're in big trouble. we're in very, very big trouble. Now I know, I was wondering why they're suffering so much. I don't know, I may even be moved to go back to things I've said over the last 25, 30 years. Not that I don't worry, but Dawson Babiram. Dawson Babiram are the two fellas who I see as most important to be studied in our day and age. I'll just give you one insight into Dawson Babiram. Dawson Babiram brothers. They're brothers. They're engaged. Two brothers are struggling. And the Medrash says, meets and means, they wanted to kill one another. It means, therefore, that Moshe Rabbeinu is saving both of their lives by separating them. He's saving their lives! So we would have thought, Shkoyach. No, they don't give him a Shkoyach, they give him a Mishnebelach. They tell him, they betrayed him. They're going to tell Paro. The Medrash says, these two fellas, listen carefully, it's unbelievable. Most people never notice it, but I've made a scientific study of Dawson Babiram. I think I'm the Yerushalayim's expert on Dawson Babiram. We see a lot of these guys around over here, Nebuch. Those are real brothers. They're locked in a struggle to the death. That's what the Medrash says. But the Medrash also says, Dawson Babiram, they're the ones that left over in Parshat Bashar, they left over from the Mon. Moshe Rabbeinu said, don't leave over any until Malayim. They left over. Dawson Babiram are the ones at the end of Parshat Shemos. They're the ones that are standing in front of Paro's palace when Moshe Rabbeinu comes out and they attack him. Since you've come over here, things have become worse. Dawson Babiram are also together in the struggle of Korach against Moshe. When you read the Medrash, you get the distinct feeling that Dawson Babiram are Abed and Costello. For the next generation that doesn't know of Abbott and Costello, Mutt and Jeff. No. The ones who don't know Abbott and Costello don't know Mutt and Jeff. These guys are Ike and Mike. Paris and Balin. These two guys, they're always doing the same thing. But the first time that they appear in Torah, they're locked in a struggle to the death. But wait a minute, they agree on everything. Why are they locked in a struggle to the death? As I said many years ago, and it remains true, Hayom Hazeh. Dawson Babiram represent the two extremes in the Jewish people. The extreme right, and I mean the extreme religious right and the extreme left. There were two groups that were vocally and violently opposed to the establishment of the state of Israel. The Turikat and Sapar on one side, and the council, the Reform Council of Judaism. Who was it? Elmer Berger with his dog? They fought war. The Hebrew University President Magnus, Martin Buber, all these Gedolim were opposed to the establishment of the State of Israel. What would happen if you take these two and put them into one room? You take Asafar Chusit, Mitakoitha Be'ika Leftis, and put them in the same room. You know what they do? They kill each other. Dawson Babiram represent the extreme within our community, and they exist. And they exist on Hayom Hazeh. We have those who went to Iran with their beards and payas and bekishes to support Ahmadinejad. Shemushamayim. And only the Kabbalah doesn't know what kind of Gehenna to create for them. But I think the only Gehenna he'll create for them is that they'll be forced to move to Eretz Yisrael. For them, there's no Gehenna worse than that. We have these extremes. But both extremes and put them into the same room. They'll destroy each other. They'll sich zerreißen wie Herrlingen. They'll tear each other apart. You know what unites them? Their opposition to the leadership of Klal Yisrael. Moshe Rabbeinu. There they both agree. That man they're opposed to. The legitimate, loyal leadership of Klal Yisrael. The middle. The center. That's who they're opposed to. Dorsum Daviram. I'm just going to say one more sentence. I'll go into the rest of it like we'll never get out of here. And maybe I'll give the full answer next week. I always used to ask about Dorsum Daviram, what I called my mother-in-law, Aleh Shalom, my mother-in-law's question. My mother-in-law, you know, there'd be sometimes people would say not nice things to you, you know, or one sibling would say something to another sibling, good, they're hurt, they're pain, b'chayis. She says, let it roll off your back. Forget about it. Let it roll off your back. Dorsum Daviram are mentioned no less than 7 times in Torah. These oisvors, what do I need them in Torah for? And if you're not going to spell Aviram correctly, that Sefer Torah is going to be puzzled. Who the hell's name needs them? They're going to make the ugliest statement in all of Tanakh. It's not enough that you took us out of a land flowing with milk and honey. They call Mitzrayim milk, the land of milk and honey. That's the ugliest statement in all of Tanakh. Who needs it? You know why you need it? Because you have to be able to identify in every generation who are the Dorsum Daviramos. Don't think that everybody who's a Kleis HaChuchim and has a whole bunch of degrees and is a university professor, his opinion is good. You know what? The opinion of Amcha, I'll tell you, the little ladies of Women in Green 20 years ago knew better than all the Gedolim in government what's good for this country. You have to know that there are Dorsum Davichams. You have to beware of them. They are opposed to legitimate leadership of Klal Yisrael. That's it, everybody. I don't think there'll be, what do you think? There'll be another snowstorm between now and then? I don't think so. Okay, everybody. Could you close that? Let me close it. I was trained.